In this episode, my guest is trailblazer Barbara Wilson, who wrote one of the very first lesbian mysteries, and Justine gives a book recommendation where the murder was in a way that you won't believe. I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, where we feature LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller fiction. Justine, do you know what kind of guest I love to have?
So I'm pretty sure the kind of guests that you like to have are authors that you have looked up to for a very long time, and authors that make your job easier by just taking a question as a suggestion and going off.
Both of those are very good. It certainly helps when I enjoy their story. But Barbara Wilson is my guest today. And what I love about Barbara is she was delightful to talk to. I had fun talking with her. And she has a fascinating background at the same time.
Great. Wonderful.
So you're in for a treat.
Good.
Very interesting. And her book is very good as well. So that always helps. And now I want to let the listeners know something. You may hear the chirping birds. And I don't want anybody ever to be confused and think they turned into a nature podcast. I didn't realize.
Pshaw. I'm always in nature.
Yes, you are. I didn't realize till I listened to a few episodes how clearly you can hear the birds and the barking dogs. So I will explain. Justine is at home, and the best Wi-Fi she gets very frequently is on her back patio. And sometimes she gets very loud crows or blackbirds that don't like her talking to me. And other times she has barking dogs and that sort of thing. So just enjoy the wilderness sounds in the background as we chat.
That's fine. I'm sure that we have at least a listener or two who find it engaging.
It certainly makes it real. They know they're not listening to NPR.
That's right. You know, not all of us can afford the fancy podcast setup.
No, that is for sure. I also want to bring up So Horrified again. I mentioned it in last week's episode, and I told people it would be on Friday and Saturday, but it didn't come out till this past Sunday, just a few days ago. So again, I was the guest on a podcast called So Horrified, and we watch absolutely terrible horror movies. As the guest, they allowed me to pick one, and I'm sure they regret it because I remembered it being bad. I don't remember it being bad nearly as bad as it was. And we had a lot of fun and a lot of laughs talking about it. So the best way to find it anywhere you're listening to this show, you can find them as well. It's Sadie and Matt are the hosts of the show, and it's called So Horrified.
Well, like with Mystery Science Theater or Svengoolie, it's more, the worse the movie is, the more fun the event is.
That is true. If somebody wants to see the movie first, it's Blood Beach, and they can watch it on YouTube. But we watched it so they don't have to. So
that's
it's
right.
Up to you. It's up to you. And the reason it's on YouTube only is because the producers went out of business almost immediately after the film was released.
Probably in the middle of it.
Yes. So
I've represented some film producers. They run out of money an awful lot. You're lucky they finished that one.
Yes. Yeah. And it doesn't even look like they spent that much money on it. But anyway, that's really all I had today. I don't have a whole lot, and I'm anxious to hear what you're going to talk about.
Well, I have found a new author, new to me author, and it's a new series called Mourning Dove Mysteries. And it would be really fitting in the theme because some of those birds you hear in the background here are called mourning doves. They're the ones that go,
I got to say, the birds today are very nice to listen to. It's song, whereas usually you have the crows that are just, bah, rah.
Well, I tell what time it is in the morning by the birds. It starts with the parrots, the wild parrots from Pasadena, then the crows, and then it goes to the songbirds. And I know when songbirds start, it's time to get up.
Well, that's a nice clock to have. Anyway, I'm going to let you get back to Mourning Dove.
And the Mourning Dove Mysteries is Murder on the Lake of Fire. And it is, as I say, there are two of the series out, and there's a third one planned for later this year. The author is Mikkel, M-I-K-E-L, J. Wilson. And his rule of thumb is no guns or knives for the murder. So the murders are unique, to say the least. The first murder in this book, and you know how you love books where I say it's only the first murder. There's always more to come. So the first murder is a skater on a frozen ice rink, an Olympic hopeful, who ends up catching fire. And how and why she caught fire in the middle of lake, and the lake is known as Lake Fire, so it's, you know, doubly poignant, doubly symbolic, is...
I want you to say again, how is this person killed?
This person is ice skating on a frozen lake and catches on fire.
Okay, I wanted you to repeat it again, because if there's ever a grabber, that is one. Because you just got to know, what the hell is that about?
That's right. It's really, I would have read it even if it was a horrible book just to find out what the answer was. Not sure I would have told you guys to read it, but this is certainly worth the read. Along the way, he's got some other, you know, interesting vignettes. The main character from whose point of view the story is told has insomnia. And so he ends up some nights having to sleep in a bathtub while candles drip on him. And in another part, the secondary character, a PI, has his office built with a series of rooms behind hidden bookcases. So you pick up a book and the door opens and you see an office. And the PI also has a pet bobcat. It's really chock full of new and original things.
Well, I want to ask, but I don't want an answer because I'm so curious. I don't understand how being in a bathtub with candle wax dripping on you would help you sleep, if I'm understanding you correctly.
That's right.
All right.
You'll have to read the book.
Yeah, I don't figure out how that one works, but...
He makes it work. He makes it work. So, this is a murder. The main character is a agent with the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, TBI. The murder takes place in his hometown, where his father is a sheriff. Then he also hooks up with a professional, a private investigator who's also investigating the crime. So the procedural mismatch between these three organizations is a tale in and of itself. And at the end, somehow they manage not to make too many mistakes. The TBI investigator cuts a few too many corners, and at the end, in the second book, he's a member of the PI firm, so you can just imagine how the first book goes. Along the way, he's got a couple of other interesting and unique sorts of murders. The clues are well-placed. Every now and then you see something, you go, I bet that's a clue, but you really have no idea how it's going to fit into the final puzzle. The characters are all unique in their own right, and the way they interact is particularly intriguing. The murder suspects keep changing, and every time you think there's a suspect, and it's going to end up this way, because along the way you've got they've got suspects on the run, and you have to catch them, so you're never quite sure who the final suspect is right until the end. It's what I call, it's getting my Cracker Jack recommendation. There's a bit of flaming involved. There's a bit of intriguing, as you've already been intrigued. And there's a little bit of thrilling, like a Cracker Jack box with a little bit of every flavor. Crunchy, nutty, sweet and salty. That is a Cracker Jack recommendation from me.
If you had asked me, I would have guessed Cracker Jack, because with a flaming body on ice, and multiple body counts, which you know I enjoy, and an ending where you couldn't guess who did it.
That
sounds
right.
Like Cracker Jack. That sounds like Cracker Jack to me.
Yes, yes. And along with the twisty, you know, winding, three sorts of procedures stepped in, and one of the main characters really can't be trusted. And at the end, I'm not sure he completely can be trusted, but we'll have to wait for future books to find out whether that assessment is true or not. And I'm hoping that the series continues for a good long while. So people need to pick up the first book and read it. Let the author know if you like it. And that always encourages authors to just keep writing.
Yes.
You know, we had one author who I had found, this book was a couple years old and it was really good. And I wanted to see that author write more. But the first book just, you know, just didn't sell. And he moved on to other things in his life besides writing. So it's always important to, one, pick up and read books and buy them. And then also tell the author what you think. Leave reviews on Amazon, but also contact the author directly.
Yes, contact the author directly. It's thrilling when somebody does that. I'm always surprised when somebody will reach out to me and they're like, oh my God, the author responded. And I don't know any author that won't respond. At least I haven't met one so far. And yes, reviews are wonderful. And if you've read something recently that was good and you did not leave a review, please go leave a review. It really, really, really helps. And not only does it help books, but it helps podcasts as well. I have to throw that in there. iTunes or Apple are the most common ones that have reviews, but there are some other apps out there as well. So you can look and see if yours does.
Yeah, always a good thing. As they say on many a podcast, rate, review, and subscribe.
Yes, because Justine and I get lots of messages. I've gotten quite a few emails this week, tweets about how much people enjoy the show. And keep sending those, but then go type up a review.
Yeah, yeah. And recommend it to your friends. Recommend the book to your friends and recommend the podcast to your friends.
You got it. This is our public service announcement. The more you know.
And not just for our books or our shows, it for every author and podcast that you like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what I mean.
So this is short and sweet, Brad, and I'm going to let you get on with your interview today.
Okay. Well, enjoy listening to Barbara Wilson. I hope you enjoy listening it as much as I enjoyed having the conversation with her. If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you hear our show. Barbara Wilson is the author of 7 previous mysteries. She is a winner of 2 Lambda Literary Awards and the British Crime Writers Award for Best Thriller Set in Europe. Her books have been translated into German, Italian, Finnish, and Japanese. As Barbara Schoholm, she is the author of memoir, travelogues, and nonfiction, and an award-winning translator. How well did I do on your last name?
Great.
And Schoholm. Great?
Yeah. Yep.
Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brad. I'm glad to be here.
I have to tell you, when I first opened your novel, Not the Real Jupiter, I was extremely excited, and let me tell you why. It's because it was in Uruguay. And not only that, it started in the Poquitos Barrio of Montevideo, which happens to be where my husband and I are seriously considering moving. And you so rarely hear anything about Uruguay. How did that come out? Have you spent some time there?
I never have, but many years ago, I was quite friendly with a woman, and she was from Uruguay. I stayed with her and her partner once and heard a lot about Uruguay, and so I've always been curious to visit there. I'd love to go, but I have not yet been.
Yeah, if it wasn't because of the pandemic, we probably would have gone this past year. So we're hoping to get there sometime soon. Yeah. So you didn't keep Cassandra there very long. You moved her up to the Northwest United States, but at least got that little bit of excitement in the beginning of the novel.
Right.
I want to tell you, as I was reading your novel, I was thinking of Michael Nava the entire time. I interviewed him about a month ago, I believe it is. And as you're probably aware, I mean, we know Michael's been writing novels for quite some time, but recently became the editor of Amble Press. And during my interview, I asked him, how is being an editor different from being an author? And he laughed and he said, well, I've learned writers are difficult to work with. in reading Not the Real Jupiter, it sounds like everybody in the publishing industry is not easy to work with. Is this true based on your experience?
No, that's not true at all. I have a wonderful editor at the University of Minnesota Press, who I've done now 4 books with on different subjects to do with Scandinavia, Christian Tibetan, and he's a paragon. He's wonderful. And I work with many, many wonderful editors, as well as some wacky ones. I certainly worked with very demanding editors when I was, when I was working at Seal Press, and I was the co-founder, as you might know, of that feminist press, and worked there 18 years. So I worked with other editors. I worked with a lot of writers, and I've kind of exaggerated a lot because of stories I've heard and stories I remember. But no, not everyone is crazy in publishing. It just seems like it sometimes.
Well, of course we're going to exaggerate, but I'm like, how much of this is real? What, there's got to be some of it, you know?
Right.
Cassandra Riley, your first book was in 1984 with her?
No, my first book with her was in 1990. I think that was Gaudi Afternoon, or was it in 91? I guess 1990. At any rate, but I did start writing mysteries and published the first one in 1984. And those were with Pam Nielsen. She was a printer in Seattle. So I wrote 3 with her: Murder in the Collective, Sisters of the Road, and The Dog Collar Murders. And then I switched to Cassandra.
In 1984 was Murder in the Collective. That was very early for a lesbian mystery.
It was the first one, really, with an amateur sleuth. Catherine Forrest published one, I think, the same year, but she had a police detective as her detective. But yeah, they were the first. There was a time when there were no lesbian mysteries.
What was your experience like being one of the first lesbian mystery authors?
To tell you the truth, it was incredibly positive. Before that, I had been writing short stories that were published in lesbian journals and in small literary journals. And, you know, about 5 people read those things. So my experience of publishing Murder in the Collective was suddenly books flying out the door. It was published in England. They brought me over to London. It was published in Germany. It was really popular. And suddenly everyone said, what's the next one? And the next one. People were really eager to read them. So that was that was unexpected. I thought I would just write the first one kind of as an experiment. But because of that, I was sort of launched into a mystery writing career without quite knowing what that meant. I don't, you know, everyone commented on the fact that Pam was a lesbian, but I think they were also quite struck by the fact that it was a collective and it was political, and it tried to bring into the mystery form discussions about politics, international politics. So all those things were wrapped in one package, and all those things were quite discussed at the time.
So you weren't just trying to put out some entertainment, you were trying to teach a thing or two as well.
I suppose I was, yeah, while putting it in an entertaining form and fast-paced mystery with a kind of semi-incompetent amateur sleuth.
Not the Real Jupiter, when this show airs, will have released last week, so everyone can go out and get it. This is May of 2021, anybody that may be listening in the future. However, the last Cassandra Riley story was The Case of the Orphaned Bassoonist. That was book number 4. And that was back in the year 2000.
Right.
What has Cassandra been doing all this time?
She's been translating. She's been traveling. She's been getting into trouble, good trouble. What I've been doing is doing a lot more translation, and I started writing nonfiction and challenging myself a great deal more in terms of academic writing and publishing with university presses as well as some mainstream presses. And I also undertook some travels of my own to the North Atlantic, BC and also up to Lapland, where I spent four different winters. So things kind of got away from me, and I've been enjoying myself, but I did miss Cassandra. And I think that especially doing more academic writing with endnotes and bibliographies, I really long for the freedom that I'd experienced writing mysteries, and especially those with Cassandra, which are a lot about language and about gender and sexuality. And I thought, I've got to get back to her and find out what she's been doing. She had aged quite a bit by the time I re-encountered her, but she hadn't lost her spirit.
And actually, that I was just about to ask you, because in Not the Real Jupiter, there's a lot of references to grain and retirement and aging in general. So she has actually aged over that time period.
She has, unlike a lot of mysteries where they stay vaguely 30, 40, maybe 50. I thought it'd be really interesting to just bring her up to her late 60s, which was my age when I started writing about her again. And I think that I'd always been kind of intrigued by this elderly spinster in mystery fiction. You know, you've got Miss Marple, you've got Mrs. Polifax and Miss Silver. And I thought, we still haven't had an elderly lesbian sleuth. So why not see what that would be like? And of course, it's very, very different. She's not sitting at home in Mary St. Mead, sort of knitting and observing. She's still out and about, as most lesbians are, actually.
Older women in general now, you don't see them in house dresses knitting with their hair in a bun all the time. Like, I know when I was growing up, that was always the image I had. And that certainly doesn't seem true anymore.
Exactly. That was my grandmother. That was my grandmother to a T. You know, she still wore the stockings with the seams and these big clunky shoes and a little hat and these kind of cotton nylon dresses. You know, she seemed as old as the hills when I knew her. I can remember her when she was in her 50s. She was old. But Cassandra's not old that way. Her hair is gray. She's still getting up to tricks.
Well, and that's what I noticed as well. She is alive and kicking and getting into mischief, I will say that. Tell us about Cassandra Riley.
Well, I don't ever go into huge amounts of backstory for her, and I don't know why that is. I think I have a clear idea of her in some ways through how she speaks and what she does. And in every book, I tell a little bit more about her. I like to keep it light, but I think there are ways in which she's developed in my mind. Even though I'm partly Scandinavian, Swedish, I'm also about a quarter Irish. My grandfather was born in County Cork, and lived in the Midwest with my grandmother. And so I had thought it would be interesting to make Cassandra an Irish-American. And that's what she is. She grew up in Kalamazoo, where my mom went to college. And she lived in a big family, and she had to get out. So she left on her junior year to Spain, and she never really came back. She has spent most of her life traveling. But her base is in London, where she has a lot of friends. And so some of what I write about her is set in London and about British publishing and about friendships with all kinds of women. But some of the stories are set in other countries, from Mexico to Romania to Hawaii and Iceland. And Europe, of course. This one is kind of unusual in that it's set in America, and it shows Cassandra kind of returning after a long period where she hasn't been in this country, and I suppose it occurred to me that it would be interesting to write about her re-encountering who she could have been if she had stayed and sort of become a West Coast dyke.
You have actually done quite a bit of living in Europe and around the world, back and forth, moving back and forth. And obviously that's reflected in Cassandra's life. now you're in Oregon, and your wife is a wildlife biologist with the Forest Service?
Right. We're in Washington, though, in the Olympic National Forest.
I guess since she was in Oregon, I assumed you were, but right. I knew you were up that way.
Right, in the Northwest, exactly.
You seem very settled at this point in your life, is the way it's coming across to me. Do you feel like that's being reflected in Cassandra at this time?
No, I don't think Cassandra is settled at all, and in that we diverge. I think for the last 15 years, since I've been living in Port Townsend, my life has been more stable, though I do travel still quite a bit and have been to Europe probably once a year at least since I've been living here. So I usually spend about a month in Scandinavia and other countries. I've been to Greece, spent a lot of time in England, France, so on. But it comes from a place of having a garden and having a life here, having friendships. And I like that. It's good for me to be in one place as well as to travel.
Yeah, I live in Los Angeles, but I don't feel settled. And I'm looking for the day that I can actually have a garden too. So I envy you.
Yeah.
The travels that you've been talking about, has any of that been due to doing some translations?
Yes, I've translated from Danish and Norwegian, and I've also written quite a bit about Lapland and the indigenous Sami people, and have been working on a book for the last year about Sami material culture, how it ended up in museums, and how it has been being returned in acts of repatriation. So I'm really familiar with Scandinavia. I spent a lot of time in Sweden and Norway in particular.
I found it interesting. I know quite a few people that had their books translated, but mostly I believe they were self-published authors. And I always just pictured a translator just sitting in a little office. And in Cassandra's life, she's traveling all over the world doing these. And it seems like a very interesting and exciting life, much more than I would expect. It sounds like there's some truth to that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, she's a restless person anyway, but she gets invited to go to different conferences, and she works with different authors in South America and Spain. And she has a lot of friends in Spain, where she lived in Barcelona for quite some time. So I think that, especially with a laptop, she can do her translation anywhere. And even though I don't translate from Spanish, I did live a year in Spain and went to the University of Granada. So I feel comfortable working with her as a Spanish translator.
Well, in her world, she has a lot of friends and cohorts who are also translators. It seems more like cohorts. Even her friends don't seem like the closest of friends, because there seems like a lot of competition between them all. Is it really such a close-knit, almost a society that works close together like that?
In some ways, I do think there's both working together and there's competition. I have several close friends who are also translators who I've known for a long time. I think that translators have gotten much more organized in the last 20 years. And I think that the American Literary Translators Association, ALTA, has had a huge effect on the lives of translators and abilities for people to get together. And there's a lot of political consciousness and really exciting things happening in translation around queer translators, translators of color, who gets translated, who gets published. Lots of really interesting discussions at the moment. I don't put those into the Cassandra books too much, but I'm aware of them, and I think they're really interesting developments.
You know quite a few languages, and you just really seem to have a passion for translation or translating. What attracts you, do you know?
I love language, and I like reading in other languages, but I also like bringing those into English and sharing them. And I think with Cassandra, it gives me a way of playing with language, too. There are lots of jokes and puns and, you know, intellectual things, but also silly things that she does with language. And I think that it gives her, in some ways, a reason for being in lots of different countries, but also for looking kind of below the surface of what's being said. So I've tried to use translation as a metaphor for sleuthing in some ways, because there's a way of paying attention to what people are saying, to sort of parsing the meaning of things that you develop as a translator. And I think that's actually somewhat similar to detection. And I think probably what interests me most about mysteries is the figure of the detective. The plots I love, but I think it's always the detective who stays in my mind with all their eccentricities and ways of approaching problems. And I think that the role of translator kind of is analogous to the detective. And I'm not so aware that anyone else has written a mystery with a translator. There could well be. But I think it is fun to have a translator as my main detective.
I have never heard of another mystery that had that, and I found that extremely interesting. Speaking of the meaning of words that you just brought up, let's get to your novel, Not the Real Jupiter. What is the meaning behind the title?
Well, the story starts out in Montevideo with Cassandra visiting her old friend Luisa Monteflores, who has, she's translated before and she's appeared in a couple of other Cassandra stories, and a publisher in Oregon who has agreed to publish Luisa's book, which is called if I can switch to Spanish, Jupiter y sus lunas, Jupiter and its moons, wants to give it a different title, Unraveling Jupiter, and putting a horrible cover on it. And she's involved Cassandra in her histrionics around this. And Cassandra is arguing with her, and it becomes apparent that Luisa doesn't even think it's about Jupiter. So that's where the title comes from, that Luisa says, it's not the real Jupiter. And that kind of lends itself to the whole book, because nothing is what it seems, and nothing is the real Jupiter in the book. But it also has kind of a science fiction theme a little bit, or a speculative fiction. And I play around with that, you know, in the categories. And I've got Asimov in there, and various discussions of what makes something science fiction or speculative fiction.
And you actually get right into that right at the very beginning of the novel, the speculative fiction and even right. discussion of science fiction.
Right. Right. That was really fun to read from that perspective and to try and work that into the book.
Well, we have a mystery, so we can't tell too much, but what more can you tell us about the story?
Cassandra goes to California. She's been invited to a conference, and she's supposed to be working on a translation. She has a deadline back in London, and she's experiencing problems with her editor there. And she then has been convinced by Luisa that she should talk with this editor, Giselle, in Portland, and try and sort this whole mess with the cover and the title out. And Cassandra is intrigued by Giselle, and her voice on the phone sort of makes her want to go stay with her. Giselle is not in Portland, however. She's on the coast of Oregon in Newport. And so Cassandra is persuaded to borrow a car and drive up to Oregon. And when she gets there, it turns out that Giselle has met with a very unfortunate accident. And Cassandra is somehow a person of interest. She's told she can't leave the country, which is a big problem for her. And one thing leads to another. She ends up going to Portland and deciding to take on the investigation herself to speed things up so that she can get to an important conference in England so that she won't be tossed from her job as a translator of a book. So that's kind of the basis. She's thrown into investigating everyone who works at this publishing company, plus a few others. Karen Morales, who is the marketing director, a woman who is the partner, a business partner of Giselle, and some other interesting figures too. An older woman who's a little bit based on Ursula Le Guin, a famous author of children's books, is in the mix too.
What I found really interesting with your novel is there were tensions in different directions. We have her trying to solve the crime, in addition to the tension she's feeling wanting to get to Europe in time, as well as dealing with other individuals, let's just say, competition that she's working with as well.
Right. You know, with mysteries, you're sort of trying to crank up the tension in different directions and trying to raise the stakes a little bit for someone. I mean, I was conscious of trying to make her life as difficult as possible. While she's trying to solve this mystery and feeling like she has a deadline, she has also desperately got to get out of the country. She doesn't want to be stuck in Portland.
Well, you definitely made her life very messy. So you succeeded there. You see it more today, but I really enjoy when it's a good mystery and I really like the protagonist at the same time, where I could almost just read a story about the protagonist themselves without the mystery. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I felt towards Cassandra.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, those are my favorite mysteries too. I'm really reading for the detective and the story.
So let's go back to, you were one of the founders of Seal Press. How did that come about? What needs were you fulfilling? What was the whole purpose behind starting Seal Press?
Well, initially, my friend Rachel and I were interested in printing and design. And I was 25, she was 24, and I had been studying printing. I was really interested in bookmaking, and she was studying art, and she had bought a letterpress. A lot of places were getting rid of their old clamshell letterpresses, so she put this in her mother's garage, and we started printing chapbooks and small books of poetry, and it was only really gradually that I kind of became aware that this could be something more. We started publishing Northwest Women in a magazine called Backbone, an annual journal of fiction, poetry, Northwest women of color. And then a woman came to us with a book about domestic violence called Getting Free, which was the first handbook for how to get out of domestic violence relationships. And we decided to take that on. So with that, we took a big step. And that book ended up being reviewed by the New York Times and selling about 3,000 copies the first month, practically. And that completely changed what we were doing. We then sort of launched into a whole series of books on domestic violence for Black women, for Latinas, for lesbians, for everybody who was in a bad relationship with violence. We also started publishing translations and fiction. And the more we published, the more we saw what we could do. And at the same time, a lot of feminist presses were also banding together in networks, and there were women's bookstores. And I think because these books were not being published by mainstream presses and they didn't see that there was an audience, we saw that there was a huge need in the absence of books, media, any kind of representation of lesbians and of feminists, thought that we could do something really important. And so Seal Press is actually still going, even though I left in 1994, and we sold it in 2000. It now belongs to Hatchet, and they're still publishing women's books, believe it or not.
I'm fascinated that you, in the late 70s, were working to put a focus on women of color, different ethnicities. That seems very early for that to be a big focus like it is today.
Yeah, I know. I don't think most people are aware that many of these issues were being discussed in the late 70s, early 80s, and that there actually was an effort by the women's presses to publish women of color. Firebrand published Audre Lorde, Zami, and Cleas published a number of books by women of color, and so did we, both international women of color from Africa and the Caribbean, but also women closer to home like Becky Bertha. And I think that's been forgotten. I think people often sort of think, oh, feminism was only about white feminism. And I think that's, I mean, in the main, that's true. We were still reproducing that hierarchy. But I do think that there was a sincere effort, and there were a lot of important books that came out then that are either forgotten or only now starting to be really taken as important as they are.
Well, I'm curious if you think I'm right in saying this. You know, looking back, especially in the early 70s, there was a large focus on feminism, and when was the ERA? That was the late 70s, am I correct?
Yeah, sometime in there, the effort to get it passed.
Working the challenges of women and feminism and women of color, it seems it's back again, but for a while there, it seems like we were lost. Am I accurate in saying that?
I would definitely say that. There was a big backlash that began to happen in the 90s. And, you know, feminism took different forms, but I do think that feminism, the Me Too movement, really rejuvenized it. And also Black Lives Matter has been hugely important in bringing Black women to the fore. So these things go in cycles. You know, we don't completely lose what was done before, but people sometimes forget what was done before. And then when backlashes happen, or things turn out a little bit differently than you expected. It's such a complicated process, and I don't understand it at all. Historical cycles. I think we're all sort of reeling from thinking, we thought things were getting better, and then they seem to be getting so much worse. But sometimes they're worse, and then they get better again. And I would say that I'm so impressed by Black Lives Matter and by the renewed discussions that are deeper discussions and more widespread discussions than we were having even when Obama was in office.
Part of it, I wonder, you know, things did get better to a degree. We had women moving up in higher positions in industry, even though we know the wage inequality was ridiculous and still is. I wonder if part of that was younger individuals growing up were taking for granted the thing trailblazers such as yourself had to go through.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think every generation takes for granted the progress that has been made, and I certainly did too. You know, my life was really, really different than my mother's and my grandmother's. So, of course, you know, younger generations would take for granted progress that has been made. And I think that it's important to recognize that the change happens. And it's also important to remind people not to take it too much for granted, because we can lose many of those freedoms. You know, older people sometimes like to harp on about, oh my God, it was so different in our day and it was so hard and you don't know. And it's important for us to tell those stories and to remind people many things are better. A lot of things are still very difficult.
Well, the listeners can't see me, but I'm nodding my head quite a bit here as you're talking.
Yeah.
I mentioned trailblazers, and in 2020, the Golden Crown Literary Society honored you with the Trailblazer Award. What is that recognition? I know what it sounds like, but can you give a breakdown of the criteria?
Well, I was very pleased and surprised to find out that they had awarded that to me. And all of what I understand about it has to do with contributions to lesbian literature. And it takes different forms. I think they've been doing it for maybe 15 years. And I was very moved, actually, to get that award. I was sorry that I couldn't attend, other than Zoom. It made me think of a lot of things. And I think what I thought about a lot was when I had been, shows how old I am, but in 1969, a girl that I was just starting to be in love with, Laura, I've called her when I've written about her. I was visiting her in Sacramento, and we went to hear Betty Friedan speak. And, you know, she was the author of The Feminist Mystique, and she was also known for all of her feminism. In spite of that, she was very anti-lesbian. And I remember when she spoke, she didn't mention lesbians at all. And Laura and I were sort of wondering, where's the place for us in this sort of great story of women, you know, taking their place in the world? And somewhere in the audience in the question time, a woman stood up and she looked to us very alone and kind of frightened. And she asked that same question that we were thinking, where are the lesbians? What about the lesbians? You haven't said anything about the lesbians. And Betty Friedan pretty much shut her down and said, well, they're of no interest to me, and I don't see them playing a role. And, you know, elsewhere, she had found them very threatening. She called them the lesbian menace, or the lavender menace, because she felt that that would make the women's liberation have so many more problems if it started talking about lesbians, because I would just drag down the whole thing. And I thought about that a lot, because it was very frightening to me to see this woman so disparaged, the woman who stood up. And I felt like I didn't have the courage. I didn't have her courage to stand up and say, but what about us? In fact, I couldn't have imagined in 1969 that there could be lesbian writers, that I could be a lesbian writer. I couldn't have imagined there could be presses. I couldn't have imagined there would be the whole LGBTQI movement, that we would stand in solidarity, just millions of us, that we would demand our rights. It was impossible to imagine that. And so to have lived through this and to have been able to have been privileged to contribute to this huge change in human society and American society has been astounding. And so I suppose that's what I think of as, as a trailblazer, is that I'm part of something. I was part of a wave, and I was able to play a role in that. And I was honored. I was honored by the Golden Crowns.
So you feel like a trailblazer yourself, that you have been?
I do, actually. That wasn't my intention when I was a little girl, to say I think I'll grow up and try and make some change in the world. You know, I always wanted to be a writer, but I did not have any kind of clue what books I would write and the effect that they might have.
Well, I referred to you as a trailblazer earlier, and it's certainly our discussion. It's quite obvious to me that you are. So I don't want to say congratulations, because you didn't win a prize. You earned this. So great job on being awarded the Trailblazer Award.
Oh, thanks, Brad. Yeah.
Well deserved. Now, you left Seal Press in the 1990s, and you worked with Women in Translation, which is a nonprofit agency. What do they do, and why did you see the need to go there?
Well, Women in Translation had actually been an imprint of Seal Press that I was mainly responsible for. And I was juggling many, many things at that time. I felt like my books were popular beyond what I had expected. Seal Press was getting bigger and bigger, and then I had also taken on this hat of trying to publish translations, and I think it just got to be too much, actually. And I thought, I was still an owner of Seal Press, I was still a vice president, but I just didn't have the time to do everything anymore. I wanted to concentrate on my own writing, and I decided to just take over Women in Translation. And we had already kind of turned it into a nonprofit press so we could continue to get some funding from the National Endowment. So I continued that on until 2004. 2004, I guess. And we didn't publish very much. It was just me and another woman, June Thomas, who is now with Slate. She's quite the podcaster. But we would do a couple books a year. Czech writers, Bolivian writers, Korean writers, women writers. So that was good. It wasn't so demanding for me. It wasn't very well paying, though, and we were very dependent on grants and things. And so I eventually decided this was also a little bit too much work for what I was getting out of it. And so I kind of slowly closed that down, too, in 2004.
Yeah, nonprofits are not known for their high wages.
No.
Not most of them. Yeah. My daughter is in Germany getting her master's degree with the expectation she wants to run some type of nonprofit agency. And I'm like, you're getting your master's degree to make how much a year?
I know. Well, you're idealistic when you're young, and I think that's great. And some things do work out very well, like Seal Press actually staggered along with the staff and, you know, being able to pay royalties. But we did have books that sold quite a lot, whereas Women in Translation, those books sold almost nothing. So it was really unworkable. So I hope your daughter finds something in the nonprofit world that also is successful.
As a proud dad, I can tell you she is going to make a difference somewhere.
So, yes.
Sure. That I have no doubt. So we've talked about your trailblazing quite a bit as far as politically and socially. Let's go back to trailblazing as a lesbian author of mysteries. What changes have you seen over the years since your initial book, and especially how things are today?
In lesbian mysteries?
In lesbian mysteries, changes over the time.
I haven't seen so many changes, to tell you the truth. I think there are a lot of lesbian mysteries published, and I think overall they present an amazing portrait of lesbian lives because so many have been published, thousands, I would estimate, at least hundreds. And they come out regularly, and they cover all aspects of lesbian life. And some are more literary than others. Some are more stylistically challenging. But for the most part, they're realistic, and I think that they give this kind of incredible changing portrait of lesbian life over the last 30 years. I was trying to think, is it 40 years? But maybe 35. Because initially, say, in Murder in the Collective, we're talking about people who lived in group houses who were in a collective. Later, we're talking about lesbians who live in pet houses and are CEOs of this and that. We're talking about lesbians who are married. We're talking about lesbians who have children. We're talking about women of color who are lesbian detectives. And I think all of those things are rich and descriptive of changes in society and the role of the detective as sort of following clues and confronting people and moving around in society as an open lesbian, but also dealing with sometimes with issues of homophobia and closeting and many, many things that are part of lesbian life. I also think that the early lesbian mysteries probably didn't have such a rich variety of people, characters in them. I think things were a little bit more separatist in the early days, and I think that changed with AIDS and with women working together with gay men and also with transgender people. I think you see lots of different people represented in lesbian mysteries now, and probably more men. I think lesbians have good gay male friends in lesbian mysteries in a way that in the early days I don't think was so true.
Well, you mentioned that they are coming out in the thousands. There have been thousands written at this point. I am always, I guess I shouldn't say I'm shocked, when I'm interviewed or on another podcast, sometimes being interviewed, and I tell them, you know, on my podcast that I interview gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, queer, individuals who write crime novels, I get this look and they're like, are there really that many? I'm like, you know, I've been doing this for almost 2 years and I barely scratched the surface. Yes, there are a lot of us, more than you think. And and the fact that you don't know this is the whole reason I'm doing this here. So,
yeah.
We are approaching the end, and towards the end, I always do awkward questions that authors get. And I surveyed dozens of authors, and they gave me listings of questions that they get that are just odd, sometimes uncomfortable, difficult, or sometimes just downright bizarre to answer. So if you hold on, I'm going to spin the wheel and we're going to see what you get. Okay, I like this one. When are you going to write something mainstream?
I have written mainstream things. I don't know if I can, you know, it's complicated to answer that because I think in some ways I have written mainstream things. I've been published by Counterpoint and Picador, and I have had a lot of books that were read by straight people. I always bring my queer sensibility to whatever I'm writing. So I think that sometimes, that's a paradoxical question, that whole idea of the mainstream, because I think I do write for the mainstream, but they don't always see the queer undertones and the perspective that I have that also informs my work. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. How do you feel about that word mainstream?
I have some idea of what it means. I think, you know, a long time ago when I was first starting out and I faced so much homophobia, it was clear to me what the mainstream was. I would say now it's less clear to me what the mainstream is, because I'm always being surprised at how many people are queer and how many young people identify in a broad array of pronouns and practices. So mainstream is almost a confusing term to me at this point. Yeah, I'll stop there. What does it mean?
I'm with you too. That's why I asked the question. Well, you mentioned queer sensibility, and it reminded me of something that I read that you said about Cassandra Riley, and I'm very curious about it. You said that she's a lesbian, but she's not an American lesbian. She's not fully a British lesbian either. What does that mean?
I think it's because she spent so much time abroad, and she spent a lot of times in Spanish-speaking countries, and especially in the early days and in the novel like Gaudi Afternoon, how lesbian and gay life did not express itself in exactly the same ways as it did in England and America, in that there was, you know, people were married, people didn't live with their partners, there may not have been as many venues for them to express themselves. And I think that Cassandra has had relationships with a number of women who don't identify as lesbian, I think. So there was no separatist movement in Spain in quite the same way. There was no sort of counterculture women's music festival, women's music. There were lots of expressions of queerness and feminism, certainly in Spain and South America, just to generalize hugely. But I think they were different than what was happening in the U.S. and in England. So I suppose that's one of those throwaway lines where I kind of want to suggest something vast without specifying too much exactly what I mean by it.
And here I made you respond to that comment.
It's a good one. It's a good question, actually.
I want to thank you for your time, and I want to remind the listeners, I'm talking with Barbara Wilson, and her latest novel is Not the Real Jupiter, which is available now, so you can go out and buy it or order it right away, and I will have plenty of links in the show notes to help you find it. Barbara, thank you very much for your time. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Brad. I've enjoyed it too.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.